What's the big deal about Dr. Seuss? Maria Russo, our children's books editor, will be here to talk about her cover review of What Pet Should I Get? Along with Alexander Alter for a very Seussian conversation.
It's set in real life. You rarely see a Dr. Seuss book that's set in real life. And when you do, it tends to be, you know, a circus or a fishing pond.
What's it like to finish writing the novel your late friend had only just begun? Jill Cement will talk about her new book, written with Amy Hempel, The Hand That Feeds You.
We actually thought of her as our third collaborator the entire time. And that made writing, you know, have another kind of impetus.
We'll let readers and listeners ask a few questions for us editors here at the Book Review, and Greg Coles has bestseller news. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul. We're going to talk about Dr. Seuss today, but before we do, I'm going to ask Alexander Alter, our publishing reporter, and Maria Russo, our children's books editor, a very important personal question, which is, what is your favorite Dr. Seuss?
I think I have to go with Green Eggs and Ham.
Why Green Eggs and Ham? Were you a picky eater? Or do you have one?
I have one, and I find it so useful. And it just cracks me up, and I can read it multiple times a day and not get sick of it, which I think is the real genius of Dr. Seuss. We all grew up reading him. Our kids are reading him. And for parents, it's just a relief to read this book that you know is going to be funny, that you don't get tired of compared to all the other books you read over and over.
Well, I have to pick an outlier that some people haven't even read. It's The Cat in the Hat Comes Back. It's the one where the cat...
A sequel.
It's a sequel, and it is so crazy, and it has this sort of high wire feeling because he comes back. The kids are still home alone, still no parents, and there's even more mischief that kind of is on this line of there's something kind of almost dangerous that about what he's asking them and what he's doing in the house. So I like that book. That book feels incredibly grown up, and yet kids love it.
I'm going to answer my own question because I also think it's an outlier, which is Dr. Seuss's ABC. Sounds so boring, and yet young Yolanda Jorgensen is yelling on his back. What could be greater than that for the letter Y? So let's now talk about the new book, which is called What Pet Should I Get? And comes out next week from Random House. What's the backstory on this book? Where did it come from? How do we have a new Dr. Seuss? Because Dr. Seuss is dead.
Right. So he hasn't had a brand new illustrated book out since Oh, the Places You'll Go, which came out a year before he died in 1991. This was a really unexpected coda to his career. You know, he published 44 books. Nobody was expecting another one to come out now. So I spoke to some people at Random House and to his assistant and learned a little bit about how they discovered this. Basically, there was this box that they had packed up when they renovated the house. It looked like it was full of abandoned sketches and sort of orphaned ideas. And when they decided to donate the rest of his materials to the archives at University of California, San Diego, they went through this box one more time and were shocked to see that there was a more complete story. It was fully illustrated. There was text taped to some of the pages. They weren't sure how complete it was, so they called Kathy Goldsmith at Random House. She worked with him for the last 11 years of his life and was sort of, you know, helped him actually finish putting the color on Oh, the Places You'll Go when he was very ill. So they felt like they could trust her to take this, you know, the bones of this project and complete it.
This isn't the first posthumous book to come out of Dr. Seuss. There were two collections of stories. There was The Bipolo Seed and other stories, and then another one that came out last year. How is this one different from those?
Well, I believe those were published in Red Book. Of course, they were new to a lot of readers who weren't around and reading Red Book. But many of them were sort of seeds of ideas that he would later elaborate on and develop into fuller books. This one has never been seen before. This is a brand new idea.
And then I guess things are also complicated by the fact that Dr. Seuss has become such a major brand and extended into TV. And there are these books that are sort of done in the vein of Seuss that will have the Seuss sort of imprint on them, but they'll be like The Cat in the Hat's Guide to Asteroids and that kind of thing, right?
Whereas this is just a Dr. Seuss book that reads like it could have been in his lineup of books that were published at the time they were written.
So can you fit this in, Maria, with what he had published at that time and sort of what came out after?
Well, I think this was probably written in 1958. The Cat in the Hat was published in 1957. That was his biggest hit ever. That was where he started to really become this brand that you're talking about. And then in 1960 was One Fish, Two Fish, Red Fish, Blue Fish. This one, I think, is kind of between those two and very much in the same mood and the same vein as those two, but maybe a little bit smaller.
And I think that the children in this book, which takes place at a pet shop, they're trying to figure out what pet to get. Are they the same children as One Fish,
and they're
two
the same children. Yeah. Exactly. They're the same children as One Fish, Two Fish, Red Fish, Blue Fish.
So there's one theory that maybe.
Do we know that? Like, is that something that Audrey Geisel and his editor have sort of confirmed? And
yeah,
said,
if you
like,
look
yeah.
at the
they
images,
look exactly
they
alike.
Look exactly the same. And one thought that the people at Random House have had is that maybe he drew these kids and had it in the pet shop and then drew some fish. And then the idea for One Fish, Two Fish came to him and got carried away. But again, it's hard to say. He didn't leave notes behind. He just left the text. So there's no real way to know what he intended to do with it or if he intended to do anything with it.
How final was the manuscript when it was found?
Basically, they had all the text and all the illustrations. He hadn't colored it in with colored pencil, which was his next step. So it was several steps short of complete.
Right. But I think that just the fact of taping the words onto the pictures, from what I understand, that was something he did very late in the process with his books because he typed and typed over and over again those words.
That's right. And one problem that they had was that his process was he would tweak the words and write it, type it up again and tape it over, but the tape had fallen off. So for some pages, they had four or five different versions of text. Sometimes it was just one word different and sometimes it was a totally different phrase. So they really had to sort of pick.
One of the misconceptions I think people have about Dr. Seuss is like the same misperception that people have of Jackson Pollock. Like, it's just a bunch of drips. I could do that. And with Dr. Seuss, because the words used are often so simple and because the meter, the anapest meter, is so distinctive, people think, well, you know, I could write this. Yes, I could. You know, it's sort of very easy to mimic. But he did a lot of work on these books.
How was his process? He did a lot of revision. According to his editors, he would sometimes produce 1,000 pages, or, you know, to get to a 68-page book. Go over them again and again, because it, with any writer, that when it looks easy, it really isn't. And that's a sign of, you know, what people call his genius, is that it does seem so easy, but it's not.
How does this book hold up, Maria?
You know, personally, it's not, I don't think it's as good as One Fish, Two Fish, Red Fish, Blue Fish, or Cat in the Hat, but it's really good. I think kids are going to enjoy it. I think it's fun. And the moment where these two kids go into the pet shop, they're parents told them they could get a cat or a dog or any pet they want, but they have to be home by noon. So they feel a lot of pressure, and they're going through all these pets there, and then all of a sudden they realize that there might be other pets that aren't even in the pet shop that are even better pets, and that's where you get the great Seuss imaginary animals. There's one called a yent who they think, oh, we should get a yent, and it's this giant, you know, furry creature, but then they say, well, but then the yent might need a tent, and who knows if Dad would pay for the tent.
So it's like the riffs in One Fish, Two Fish,
exactly.
Red Fish, Blue
so
Fish,
they,
where...
Yeah, so they kind of become carried away with their imaginary animals, and then they realize, wait, we have to be home by noon, and there's this pressure on them, and this great two-page spread that occurs twice in the book that says, make up your mind. And I think that's really the point of the book, the message of the book, is that it's hard to make up your mind, and there's this pressure to do it, and they do it. They come out of the pet store with a creature in a basket, but we don't know what creature they chose because all we see are the eyes.
It's a very different message from One Fish, Two Fish, Red
exactly.
Fish, Blue Fish, which
yeah.
ends on, you know, from here to there, from there to here, funny things are everywhere.
Right. This was, and I think that for me, that's one of the reasons why I think he decided to put it in the drawer and put it aside. It's that it's set in a store, and there's all of this pressure on them. It's set in real life. You rarely see a Dr. Seuss book that's set in real life. And when you do, it tends to be, you know, a circus or a fishing pond. And I think the idea that it was set in a store in the end kind of didn't quite sit right with him. And so, as Alexandra's saying, I think he then started playing around with, let's just go with the imaginary animals. And then he started with the One Fish, Blue Fish imaginary animals, and they're incredible. You know, the gox, I like to box, like box my gox and yellow socks. And that became so much more the kind of thing he wanted to do, especially I think at that point in his life when Dr. Seuss, this is, you know, in the late 1950s, was turning into a brand. He had a whole imprint at Random House called Beginner Books, where he was editing beginner readers, you know, other
writers.
Was that
uncommon at that point for a children's book author and illustrator to become so sort of...
Oh, yeah, it was completely. He was really the first one to become kind of a juggernaut, like in the Harry Potter vein, really, that we see today, but obviously for younger children. So he had a lot going on, and a lot of it was really commercial. And I think that he just didn't, personally, this is my theory, is that he really didn't want to publish a book that was set in a store. And so he took these kids and he put them into One Fish, Blue Fish, and they had so much more fun, and they didn't have to worry about being home by noon.
And they didn't have to make up their mind.
And they didn't have to make up their mind. They had all the pets.
So speaking of decisions, how did this get from, they found it in a box, to publication, Alexander? What was the road like? Was it a smooth path? Or was it this Harper Lee kind of?
Well, I think with posthumous publications, it's a lot simpler, right? He might not have wanted it published, but here it is. I mean, the world wants to see it. His widow, his assistant, his publisher all agree that it holds up. So I think they pretty quickly decided they wanted to publish it. They had the scans made, and Kathy Goldsmith started finishing it. She picked out this color scheme by consulting his other books.
And Kathy is?
She is the
art director, right?
Yes, she was. She's still at Random House, and she worked as his art director with him on 5 or 6 of his final books. You know, she ordered his art supplies. She was very involved. I mean, she would stay at his house and help him work on stuff when he was ill. So,
and I think that's one of the, if I may talk about the Harper Lee comparison that people are inevitably making. That is a big difference. Is that this is a book that clearly would have been published if he had followed through with it and presented it to his publishers, and there's not really any question around this of something that really wasn't ready for publication, or, you know, an editor didn't judge it unpublishable. It was really his choice.
I have to ask this because all three of us have Dr. Seuss readers in our household. Have you read this with your kids?
Well, I have with my 4-year-old.
I did. Yeah. I took a test drive with my 5-year-old and my 3-year-old.
And?
They loved it.
Yeah, mine too.
My 6-year-old did too.
And asked for it the very next day.
And
which
then
is
started asking
sign.
Me if we could get a pet.
Well, those are the reviews that really count, right? All right, Maria, Alexandra, thanks so much.
Thank you.
John Williams joins me now with more Dr. Seuss. Hi, John.
Hi, Pamela.
So we decided to ask after our conversation with Alexandra and Maria, ask our readers and listeners what their favorite Dr. Seuss is. John, some of the answers?
Well, we got a lot of feedback, and so we just picked a few here to be representative.
But everyone has a favorite Dr. Seuss.
Not surprisingly. Everybody loves Dr. Seuss, and everybody has their own favorite. Mine is If I Ran the Circus. And
you don't?
I'm still aspiring to that one day. Ramona Ponce, who tweets as Ramona right now, wrote, "The 500 hats of Bartholomew Cubbins, always fond of frippery, that progression of ever more marvelous millinery delights me." So the question brought out people's, you know, playful Seussian style.
I think Dr. Seuss is made for Twitter.
I think so, too. Tristan Carrasco said, "The Cat in the Hat, iconoclast, rule breaker, agitator extraordinaire. I blame him for all my first grade behavior demerits." Storyville Dispatches wrote, "The Grinch. He hadn't stopped Christmas from coming. It came. Somehow or other, it came just the same. Gets me every time." And then several people pointed out, you know, that Seuss's lessons when they were young left a really lasting impression. And Katrit is one of those people. She writes, "The Sneetches. Even at 5, I appreciated that the more we tried to be different, the more we were really the same, star or not." And Megan Beauchamp says, "The Lorax. It changed my perspective of the relationship between man and nature with one simple word, unless." And then some people were very funny. Jennifer Holmes wrote one of my favorite responses. She says, "Fave Dr. Seuss books, Cat in the Hat, because I'm a rule follower and I always identified with the fish in the pot." So I guess not everyone is into the stars of the book.
I was the fish in the pot, too. Anything
I think
else?
I may have been too. Maybe that's why I like that one so much. I'll finish with another playful one. Gail Pittman wrote, "Hop on Pop. That's the first book I could read by myself, and I liked saying Constantinople and Timbuktu."
Very good. Although I've heard recently from some fathers that resented the message in that book, or the methodology.
Yeah, I'm sure. They got several bruises out of it.
All right. Thanks, John.
Thanks, Pamela.
Jill Cement joins us now. She is a novelist and a memoirist and is the co-author of a new book, The Hand That Feeds You by A.J. Rich. Hi, Jill.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. So you have one co-author, strictly speaking, and then a third co-author. Can you explain a little bit about the origins of this novel?
This novel was a novel that Amy and I decided to write, Amy Hempel and I, about 3 years ago, shortly after the death of a friend of ours. And she was a nonfiction writer. Her name is Kathy Russell Rich, and she was about to write a novel about an experience she had and unfortunately got sick and died before she had a chance. And so Amy and I decided to utilize the experience that we had lived with her through, which is she was involved with a man that she met on the London Review of Books. They fell in love. It was a long-distance relationship, and they met at these romantic getaways, and she read us her emails. And this is a dying woman, so you want this to work out more than anything. And so we loved him, we hated him. Then she discovered via a hacker that he had many other women in his life and that he was sort of a sociopath.
Let's talk about Catherine Russell Rich. Kathy was the author of a memoir, The Red Devil, and the book Dreaming in Hindi. I should make it clear now, too, that I also knew Kathy, and she was working also on a nonfiction book, too, when she was sick at the time that she was. She'd never written a novel before.
No, she'd never written a novel, but this experience inspired her, let's just put it.
How did you know Kathy?
She published The Red Devil with the same editor that I had, and we became friends, fast friends after that.
Kathy was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer and lived with it for 20 years.
Yeah, she was diagnosed and given 2 years to live at 32, and lasted 25 years.
She also wrote about this diagnosis in the Times for the science section. How did you decide that you would take this, you know, nebulous idea and turn it into a novel? Was it something that you and Amy decided together to do, or did one of you want to do it and then convince the other?
No, you know, we came up with it together, like any two friends, you know, hey, let's do the book. And you think to yourself, you know, people probably say that, you know, a lot and never do the book. And somehow we just sat ourselves down. We were both in Williamsburg, Brooklyn at the time. And we just spent the whole summer writing.
Okay, now we should say that this novel is very different from the kind of writing that you and Amy do separately.
Yes, it's very different. This is a genre book. It's a thriller.
Psychological thriller.
Yeah, it's a psychological thriller. And, you know, we are incredible fans of psychological thrillers. We never, ever thought of this as writing down. We just thought of it as writing differently.
Both of you are what one might call literary fiction authors.
For lack of a better name.
What was it like to tackle a thriller?
Well, you know, plotting in any novel is, you know, if it's done well, it's as intricate. What was really fun about doing this was, you know, I've never tackled the subject matter of murder and sociopathic behavior. I mean, it's usually not the terrain of a literary novel. So that part was really fun. But honestly, it's pretty much the same as writing any novel.
But you also had a co-author in this. And how was that different?
That was amazing. Okay. I mean, both Amy and I have not so much strong suits, because obviously we both have to do everything as writers, but we have places in our writing where we're very confident. And so what would happen would be she's very confident on the sentence level, and I'm incredibly confident in the global level. And so what was extraordinarily interesting was to see, first of all, how another person wrote. I mean, it's such a secret. And writers say, oh, yes, I start in the morning, I drink a cup of coffee. But to actually witness the way another human being writes and thinks, it was remarkable.
Did you decide, oh, I'm going to do that from now on? Did you sort of take anything from the way that Amy works and think?
You know, it's not possible. This book is such a collaboration, I wouldn't know where Amy began. It would be like trying to understand a marriage by saying, well, who takes out the garbage and who puts away the dishes from the dishwasher? It's like this. It's a kind of complicated, enmeshed relationship.
But when people write books together, there are obviously a number of ways that you can work. Sometimes one person will do one chapter and send it to the other, or they'll sit in a room together and work. How did you actually sort of work it out in terms of the day-to-day writing?
Again, at the beginning, we wrote together. Every sentence, Amy and I wrote together. No one ever worked without the other one being present. After a while, she went to Connecticut and I went to Florida. And so we wrote on Google Drive. So we were both looking at the same screen and we were on the telephone. You know, and sometimes we'd talk an idea and she'd say, wait. And I would see it just appear on the screen. It was like so cool.
One of the things you hear from writers, novelists, and people, the kind of writers who are used to working alone, is when they go into TV and they're in a writer's room, how very different that kind of collaborative back and forth atmosphere is from the usual total isolation.
It's really exciting after, you know, having been in solitary confinement for 30 years. It's really exciting to bounce ideas off of another person and realize that, you know, you call upon a different area of yourself. I mean, when you're writing by yourself, you're kind of calling upon your idiosyncraticness. You're calling upon your individuality. And when you're writing with somebody else, you're calling upon a kind of universal idea that two people can agree on.
With Kathy Rich's actual experience with this imposter guy, obviously it had a certain ending. Did she want her novel to have a different ending? Did she have an idea of what ending she wanted?
You know, I have no idea. None whatsoever. I mean, we talked to her, or I talked to her about the novel, and I don't really have an idea of what she was looking for.
So did you and Amy think, what ending would Kathy have wanted? How did you figure that out?
It would be more the beginning. It's okay to say we kill off the horrible suitor within 4 pages, and that was sort of what inspired us to—
That was Kathy's revenge.
That was Kathy's revenge.
How does it feel, you know, again, having done this as a tribute to a late friend?
It kind of feels amazing. I mean, it's been really moving for everyone who knew Kathy. Everyone knows how much she would have loved this idea. I mean, she's such a kind of go-getter and someone who would have loved to have tried something crazy. We actually thought of her as our third collaborator the entire time, and that made writing, you know, have another kind of impetus.
One of the things that struck me when Kathy died, for me, it was my first sort of real Facebook death, in that there were so many people, she had so many friends and people she'd worked with as a longtime magazine editor as well, that her Facebook page lived on for a long time, where writers kept writing about her, and it felt like she was sort of still there.
And we hope the book does that too. I mean, that was part of what drove Amy and I, was the idea that, I mean, Kathy's picture is in the New York Times, that she's, and she was a writer, and, you know, most writers I know want to have posterity.
For the writer, Catherine Russell Rich, thank you so much, Jill.
Thank you for having me.
Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Pamela.
What's new on the list?
Starting on the hardcover fiction list, there are 4 new titles. Down at number 15, Don Winslow has a book called The Cartel. It's a very timely book. It is about the Mexican drug wars, and it specifically looks at a jailbreak of a Mexican drug lord back in 2004. So coming on the heels of El Chapo and his second jailbreak.
I was going to say, how did he plan that?
It's a very good timing. That one's new at number 15. Then at number 7, Stuart Woods continues his Stone Barrington series. It's the 34th book in the series, called Naked Greed. That's new at number 7. At number 4, Ernest Klein, who previously hit the list with a book called Ready Player One, has a new book called Armada. It continues his whole gaming premise. Ready Player One was a book about video games. Armada is a book about a teenage gamer who's been playing a game called Armada. It's sort of like a Space Invaders type game that turns out to actually have been training him all along for a real life space invasion, at Armada of alien ships.
Sounds a little Ender's Game to me.
Yeah. Then new at number 1.
Big shock.
Yeah, no surprise at all. Harper Lee has her, quote, new old novel or draft or whatever you want to call it, Ghost Had a Watchman, the book that eventually became To Kill a Mockingbird. That book has sold over 1 million copies in its first week, and there it is at number 1.
Looks like there's a big new number 1 on the nonfiction side as well.
There is. I'll get to it in a second. But first I wanted to mention there's also a new title down at number 9. Arthur C. Brooks's The Conservative Heart shows up there, and that's reviewed in our August 2nd issue. Then, yes, at number 1 on the nonfiction list, there's a new title there, Ta-Nehisi Coates, Between the World and Me. It's a short book, but a long essay written as a letter to his teenage son, kind of talking about what it means to be Black in America these days.
All right. Very interesting parallels there in fiction and nonfiction at number 1. Thanks,
yeah.
Greg.
Thanks, Pamela.
I'm also going to ask Greg a question that was sent in from one of our readers via Twitter, from Alexis Wilder. And it's a big one. It's our job. He asks, or she asks, what criteria do you use to determine which books get reviewed? Greg, since you do that.
Cash, mostly, but I also take checks. No, I'm kidding. I mostly handle fiction, and the books that I assign generally reflect my personal taste, which happily encompasses a lot. from straightforward psychological realism to comic farce to more postmodern or experimental fiction, playing with the form or challenging our expectations. I get very tired of the same formulas repeated over and over, whether it's genre or quote-unquote literary fiction. I have very little patience for books that claim to illuminate the redemptive power of storytelling and what it means to be human. But I'm drawn...
So cold-hearted, Greg.
I'm drawn... I like sentences. I'm drawn to stylish prose and strong voices, books that let you see the author's mind at work, the play of ideas on the page. I don't, you know, if a book has a cover that shows an explosion and a man running away, I might not assign that one. But mostly the books that I assign are just the books that I respond to.
What I think is interesting, too, is that there are occasions when you'll come in to talk about a book and we'll say up front, this book isn't my taste or this book isn't for me. But that said, I can see how some readers, so you are able to kind
it's
of.
It's true. I'd say a couple of things about that. First of all, my taste has expanded since I took this job because I've been exposed to so much more. I used to read much more within a narrow area of fiction than I do now. And so I've started seeing what there is to recommend things that I maybe wouldn't have turned to before. And then beyond that, there are things that might not personally speak to me either. I think the prose is weak or the storyline is fairly familiar. And yet it has something that I can still see why our audience might respond well to it. It's an especially timely story or, some element of it is really well done. So I am able, even as my taste has expanded and there's more that I like now, I'm also able to recognize what might make a book worthwhile, even if it's not a book just for me.
All right, Alexis, you have your answer. Thank you so much, Greg. We will take more questions from listeners and from readers, so please feel free to email them to us at books@nytimes.com or to tweet them directly at us at nytimesbooks on Twitter. Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.